This is File 78. This is Gene McMillan. I'm interviewing Roger McKee at the Scoville Memorial Library. He's going to talk a lot about boat building and Salisbury School and anything else he can think of. Today's date is August 27th, 2014, and here we go. What is your name?
Roger McKee.
And your birth date?
5/14/1954.
And your birthplace?
Sharon.
And your parents' names?
Howard McKee and Francis McKee.
Do you have siblings?
I do. One brother, Randy, who's older.
And what is your educational background, please?
I went to grammar school at Salisbury Central School. I went to Salisbury Boys School for high school. I then spent a year and quarter at MIT, took some time off, got an art degree from Pratt Institute, and then more recently a master's of liberal studies from Wesleyan.
Okay. How did you get to Salisbury School? You had an interesting story.
Oh, you mean as a student or as a...
Well, you can start as a student. You can start as a student.
As a student, I remember there were a number of us, Bob Dufour, John Harney, we were in the same class, and I believe it was Art Wilkinson approached us or suggested, you know, that maybe... one of the private schools might be a way to go, and encouraged us to take the PSATs. And that's my recollection.
Would this have been through the recreation program with Art Wilkinson?
I would guess so.
Okay.
But we, you know, we sat for the SATs and did well, and there were a number of us who went up that year. Then, as far as the teaching there, after I had gone off to college, and I was living down in West Cornwall, doing artwork, doing odd jobs, trying to get by. And Salisbury School had an opening for a math teacher. They had a previous math teacher who had left in the middle of the summer to take up another job. Carl Williams, who was at that point the chairman of the math department and who had been a teacher of mine, I think all 4 years that I was there. He taught the higher level math classes, so he would... But in any case, Carl knew me, knew my background, called my parents, because he didn't know how to get in touch with me. My parents, the next time I saw him, said, Carl Williams called, give him a call. And he said, would you be interested in teaching freshman algebra and some geometry? And I said yes. And so I took a job teaching math at Salisbury School, which I did for 3 years.
When did you go to Salisbury School first as a math teacher?
1980.
Okay. And who was the head at that time?
That would have been Ed Ward.
Okay.
Yeah. And I did the math for 3 years, and then and during that time, I believe, I sort of started to slip into the art department in that I taught a class... basically sort of developed and taught a class in drafting, mechanical drawing, which we did with, you know, paper and pencils and T-squares and triangles and things like that. And then the fellow who was the chairman of the art department then went off to Colorado to another school, and I moved fully into the art department. We ultimately did the drafting with CAD programs, At some point, we switched over from paper pencil to CAD, and I did this sort of...
What's CAD?
Oh, computer-aided drafting.
Oh, thank you.
Or computer-aided design, but yeah. Basically, you throw away the pencils and you use the computer.
Okay.
Makes much more uniform lines.
Saves on paper, too.
And then, yeah. And then, well, we did the usual sort of high school art kinds of subjects. There was drawing and painting. There was some printmaking. We had a little tiny pottery in one of the outbuildings of the school. But of course, now, I mean, sort of fast forward, now we've got a really nice, very well equipped facility with a dedicated pottery, a printmaking studio, a painting drawing studio, a wood shop. And because of starting the woodworking program, that now takes up a fairly harsh percentage of my teaching time. My colleague does the pottery and the painting and drawing. I have one drawing course and one printmaking course that I do, but the rest of my time is really filled with the woodworking classes, which are pretty much filled each trimester, and then boat building, which is also a new, relatively new development. I'm going to say it was 2001, which isn't actually so new.
Well, yeah,
it's been a number of years.
I'm going to go back for a little bit of statistics. Presently at Salisbury, who is the headmaster?
Chisholm Chandler.
And what is approximately the student enrollment?
Right around 300. Could be a little less, could be a little more.
And how about the faculty?
That's one of those things I should have looked up. I'm gonna say roughly 60 faculty, but if we included all the Reading Center staff and other...
The part-timers and...
people, it could go quite a bit higher than that.
In your various classes, what's the average number of students? Does it fluctuate?
It does. I mean, I think the class average for the whole school is probably somewhere around 12.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but that can be...
It fluctuates.
That can vary dramatically. Yeah. In my department in particular, we're fortunate that we tend to bring the average down. I mean, there are some, you know, sort of standard, you know, like freshman algebra, for instance, where those classes probably run 15 or so. But, for instance, the woodshop, for safety reasons, we haven't sort of an official maximum of 6. I've done 7, but...
Yeah.
That's sort of the official maximum in the woodshop. That's how many people I can sort of, you know, keep track of and make sure nobody's cutting something off.
And you have to be really careful with safety issues.
Yeah. And then the boat building is sort of self-selecting. I mean, it's because it's such a involved
process.
And because in some instances it can cost a little bit more money. The number of guys who are interested in doing that is relatively few. So I've had anywhere from, well, the maximum was 11 guys building boats at one time, which was a little crazy.
Yeah.
To only 3, which is like sort of underutilization of my time. But usually it's around 6.
Okay.
Which kind of works.
I want to get into the boat building, but again, I'm going to go back to some of the faculty members. Did you work with Kiao Loy?
Yes. I mean, Kiao was there when I was a faculty member.
And he was
in the math teacher, and chairman of the math department. And since the math and the arts guys don't mix all that much.
Okay.
But yeah.
And did you work with Carl Williams as a faculty member?
Yes.
Now, he was chair of the math department until he retired, or not?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have no idea what year that would have been.
That's all right.
But Carl, right up until the very end, Carl never really severed his ties with Salisbury School. He was, not only was he up there a lot and sort of you know, a presence, but he continued to coach the ski team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean,
oh yeah,
I'm going to say it until he was 90.
Probably.
He would, you know, so he would come up in the winter and he would, you know, drive the, you know, drive one of the school vans up to Butternut and they, mm-hmm. wherever they practice, I think Butternut. And, yeah, so that was kind of the ski team was his baby. He'd been doing that for...
Oh, years and years.
Yeah.
Now, you had...
I also had Carl as a faculty member.
I would think so.
There's an anecdote that to tell people that we used to refer to him as Quick Carl. In our classroom at the time, there were blackboards.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do what I mean actually, but blackboards on three walls of the room.
Uh-huh.
The other wall had windows.
Oh, really? Oh.
And the story was that Carl would be writing a proof with chalk with one hand, and as he walked around the room, he'd be erasing the stuff with the other hand as he went around. You know, so if you weren't taking notes real quick,
you lose it.
You were lost. And there's a grain of truth to that. I'm sure that the thing about him doing, you know, writing and erasing with two hands is apocryphal. But yeah, he was a demanding teacher. Yeah.
But I would think he would be a good teacher.
He was. Oh yeah.
And I mean, it was very much on top of it.
Sort of good teacher and demanding.
They sometimes go together.
Yeah.
Because there are standards that he would maintain that you just had to live up to.
Yeah.
Which is always, I think, a good thing. Now, you had some wonderful stories about Jim Bates. Not as a faculty member, per se, but the wilderness experience.
Okay, so the sophomore class, there actually was a period in time where Salisbury had the entire school during that same time frame of just before or just after Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
Where the entire school would go off on these various trips. The freshmen went to Montreal. Sort of a cultural, a lot of kids were taking French, so the seniors were theoretically supposed to be using that time to look at colleges and go on college visits and that, and the junior class was doing historical literary trips. They went to places like Gettysburg and
Ooh.
Things like that, but those other programs, the other classes, those kind of fell away, and the sophomore wilderness trip was the longest lived, mm-hmm. and we still have faculty. We have faculty now who were students who went on the wilderness trip, who still talk about it, and who still think it was the greatest thing that one of the greatest things they
sure.
ever did. And we would take the entire sophomore class up to the Adirondacks. There was a faculty connection with a Boy Scout camp on the eastern shore of Lake George, and that would be our base of operations. There was in the camp there were some buildings with propane heat and stoves and things like that, and there was a kitchen, so that we could during the day when there was a program going on, we could make lunch and serve it to the boys, so just to keep the day running more smoothly. And Jim would go along on those trips. I think he, I don't know if he went on all of them, but he went on a
fair number.
Most of them, yeah. And he would be kind of like our guy in the kitchen. He would he'd sort of, you know, run the place. He'd make sure that the food stuff was organized, and he would get lunch going early so that when the kids came by at 12 or 12:30, whenever, he would serve them a cup of soup, a sandwich, whatever, out the window of the building and send them on their way. And then, since the faculty were all out during the day with the student groups doing things, he would stay back in the shelter, I forget what we call it, activities building, I guess, and have dinner ready. For us, the kids would make their own dinner. That was part of the experience for them to select the food and cook their own dinner out in the wilds. But the faculty would get to come back and have something that Jim had at least started, and we'd help out. But
that's good.
Chief cook and bottle washer for the group, which was kind of nice.
And he did that for a long period of time, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't recall exactly how many years we did the wilderness program, but it was at least 10 years
mm-hmm.
in a row.
That's a good long time.
Yeah.
Now I do want to go back to the boat building. Tell me how you got involved with it at the beginning, right up to what you're doing now. Please.
It was student generated, essentially. We had a boy who was had some learning differences, and he had a language waiver. So he didn't. So there was a whole every trimester there was a course that he didn't have to take. He didn't have to take Spanish or French or whatever. So he had free time. So, but the requirement was that he still had to take a fifth course. So what he did was he took our courses. And he very quickly ran through all the art courses that we had. He'd done some of them, he'd taken more than once. And so somebody came up with this idea. Well, there's this company, Chesapeake Light Craft, in Annapolis, Maryland. They make boat kits. And Elliot was the fellow's name. He lived on the water. He was a rower. He liked boats. Wouldn't this be a cool thing? He could make a boat. And he did, and it was very successful. There were a few false starts. We had to find a place to actually do the work. We initially started in the headmaster's garage, but it wasn't warm enough. The epoxy wasn't setting well enough. We scrapped that idea very quickly. We found a space. It was actually what was at one point the original wood shop. And it was no longer being used as a wood shop at that point, so we took it over. At least it had heat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll briefly describe the process. The parts, the marine mahogany plywood, are pre-cut to shape, and the pieces are then wired together with copper wire, which is relatively soft. But because the parts are pre-shaped, when you pull the wires up tight, this whole thing kind of pops into shape, and then you weld the seams with epoxy, and then you pull the copper wires out. It's actually kind of a tedious process.
That's all right.
And even if you can't get a wire out because the copper's soft, you can sand it flush. And it rips up your sandpaper a little bit, but it's not bad. And then you, in some cases, depending on the boat, some cases you may apply some fiberglass cloth to reinforce that, or in some of the boats, parts of it were simply epoxied, and that was it. It was just the wood, the plywood with the epoxy over it. But that was successful. And then a couple years later, we had five guys who made sea kayaks by the same process. And then over the years, we had a number of guys who either made sea kayaks, or there was a little pram, a little 8-foot pram, a little rowboat that some guys made. There were a couple other different boats. Oh, there was what they called an Oxford shell, a single rowing shell. And then, sometime after that, a former faculty member at Berkshire School showed me how to make skin-on-frame canoes, which are essentially little solo boats. They're 11 and a half, 12 feet long. They're really meant to hold one person, though. Their carrying capacity is about 300 pounds. You could take an adult and a child, which is what I used to do with my son when he was smaller. And they're an open canoe. You sit on the floor and you paddle them with a double-bladed paddle. What we would think of as a kayak paddle, though it's kind of extra long. And those are relatively easy to make, less expensive. We build them from scratch. It's a way for me to introduce the guys who do that to the wood shop, because we do all the milling of the parts right from day one. So they not only learn how to build a boat, but they learn how to use the wood shop tools and things like
mm-hmm.
that. Sort of a combination of hand tools and power tools. And then I've gotten interested in building Eskimo kayaks, Greenland kayaks. So I've built four of those. Yeah. I got the fifth one is kind of in the works. And along the way, I got a little bit sidetracked making coracles. A coracle is a round, more or less round, maybe egg-shaped Welsh, traditionally
yes.
thought of as a Welsh
yes.
boat, though it turns out that they show up all over the world. In Cambodia, there's a boat they make out of bamboo that's essentially a coracle. The Plains Indians used to make a thing called bulbo, which was...
How do you spell that one? Do you know?
Bulbo. B-U-L-L-B-O-A-T. It's because it was the hide of one buffalo, one bison, stretched over a kind of round frame that they could use to get across a shallow river or something like that.
Okay.
the first one that I built was actually made from leftover plywood that I had from one of the other projects. And it's actually works very well. It's quite sturdy because it's wooden epoxy, but it's much heavier than a traditional coracle would be. And then I got got a grant from the Connecticut Commission on Tourism and the Arts, Culture and the Arts. They made their name longer, and I can never remember it. But
that's all right.
But a grant from the state of Connecticut to build coracles. There was a grant application going around. And I said, well, I could apply as a printmaker, but you know, maybe I'll just apply in the crafts area. And so I pitched this idea of making coracles, and they
bought it.
They bought it, and I made one more or less traditional, what's called a Boyne coracle. And coracles are kind of classified by what river system they came from in Wales and Scotland and Ireland. I mean, this first one was made of willow rods and covered with leather. I actually used leather and sewed it together to make it so it looks fairly traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one was a Iron Bridge coracle named for the bridge near Shrewsbury.
Oh, yes, I know it.
And apparently the history is that it was a toll bridge, and the locals didn't want to pay the toll, and so everybody would have a coracle, and they'd use it to get back and forth across the river. But it's made of wood slats, and they're usually traditional ones were usually covered with some kind of cheap fabric, and then tarred, which is really, you know, is kind of ugly and sticky. And so I didn't do that. I covered mine with fabric, but I used a clear polyurethane to cover it. So it's actually quite a handsome little craft. And then I took the remaining part of the grant and made one with a local metal fabricator out of stainless steel.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
It came out nicely. And currently, I hope this won't last too long, but currently that one is sitting at the bottom of Gordon Conkerline's swimming hole behind his farm. Because my son and I were going down to Salmon Kill one day, and he went under the bridge just before the swimming pond, and there's a little dip, and he tipped over. They are notoriously unstable.
Oh, yes, they are unstable.
And because the thing has no flotation, it went right to the bottom. And I've been over a couple times swimming, trying to find it, and I unsuccessfully, and it's been a really wet summer, so the water's been high. I'm going to wait until the water gets a little lower and go back and... I said Gordon Conkerline. I said Alan Conkerline.
I knew who you meant.
Yeah, he's been very good about letting me go over and swim.
John Malin.
Well, it isn't really that deep. I don't understand why I haven't been able to find it, because when I go in with
currents,
you know, with a mask and go down, and I'm actually convinced now. I'm thinking what I've done previously. I'm thinking that it may have gotten caught in a backwash and be maybe tucked up
over the side,
further upstream than I think it is.
Yeah, that's a good
eventually
project.
I mean, it's not going to rot. Eventually, it's stainless steel after all. Eventually, I'll.
It'll be quite an interesting artifact 50 or 60 years from now if you don't get it out of there.
Yeah.
All right. Now I'm going to throw you a curve. Oh, how many boats have you done?
It's over 80.
Yeah.
I do a count every year. After I'd done a few of them, I started keeping track, and I kept track of when they were built and what kind of boat and who the students were. But I did a workshop this summer for the Salisbury Summer School where we made four new boats. And my last tally, it's definitely over 80.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how long have you been doing this, making boats?
Since 2001.
So you've been doing it for about 13 years.
Yeah.
Good average.
Yeah.
All right. Now my curve. You went to Salisbury as a student, and you've taught there, you said, 30 years?
It will be 35.
35 years. Oh, right.
I am, in fact, there was some, at the end of this past school year, Ralph Manconi, who was the senior master, that was his official title. He's the faculty member who'd been there longest, and he retired.
Oh.
And there are some duties attached to the being the senior master. Only you're kind of in charge of the procession at graduation, of making a list of who goes where, who's first in line, second in line, so on. And also, you get invited to all of the trustee dinners rather than just.
That's nice.
But Ralph was retiring, and so we were trying to calculate who was next in line for the position. Dennis Shortell or myself. Quite frankly, I didn't want it. but it turned out that it was Dennis, which was announced in the headmaster's letter to the faculty over the summer that Dennis was going to be the, you know. But that means that I'm second in line.
That's right.
And if I've got 35 years, then Dennis must have 38 or 37 or anyway. But yeah.
Then how has the school changed over the years? Yeah, I know that's I should have asked you that before. More programs?
Yes. So our numbers have gone up. And that in and of itself means if you have more faculty, you can have more offerings, you can have a greater variety of courses. The physical plant has altered beyond recognition. For me, the kind of interesting thing, and back when he, sort of to backtrack for a little bit about Jim Bates, one of the things that Jim used to do when he was at Salisbury was to get up at least once a year and do a little historical vignette for the students, tell them a little bit about where they were. And one of the things that he started pointing out, and I've noticed, you know, all of the buildings have names, which, you know, they're named for former faculty, or in some cases, for benefactors. Mm-hmm. But, Kerr House, for instance, which is now a faculty, was a dorm when I started it as a student,
yeah.
Now is a faculty resident. Kerr House was named for Wim Kerr. Wim was my geometry teacher. Mm-hmm. Carr, that was Mr. Carr, who I did not have as a teacher. I'm trying to think who else. Tappert Dorm. Ed Tappert was, he taught like classical languages, and so I didn't have him, but I knew him. He was mm-hmm. there as a teacher when I was there.
I remember from something that I think Jim Bates said that chapel originally was in the basement of one of the main buildings.
Yes. Now that I only know from listening to Jim, but mm-hmm. there is, when I started as a student, if you went into the main building and went through what we called the common room, which was a sort of a central gathering area where we had school meetings, and at that time it was a small enough student body that you could have entire body in this room, which couldn't have been more than 30 feet square. I mean, mm-hmm. but you went down the stairwell, and there was this room, which at the time was our library. But you could tell that it had been a sort of a nice space. It had carved wood paneling,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if it even had sort of stained glass. I mean, simple rectangles, but sort of stained glass. But
more ornate.
But it was a very small space, low ceilings. And at that point, this would have been in 68 when I started as a student, it was the library. Mm-hmm. Still, very small for a library.
Yeah.
I mean, small for a chapel, small for a library. But apparently that had been the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the chapel was built, which had been done by 68, it was this beautiful big chapel, which we did not fill at the time. I mean, we didn't come anywhere near close to filling it. We overfill it. We have chairs down the, down the side aisles for the faculty to sit in. And they added new pews in the back for the freshman class. But the whole basement of that main building had a whole life. Now, to sort of bring us up to date, now that room, after it was no longer the library, there was a new library built. And in fact, the students helped move the books.
Mm-hmm.
That was not a big task because there weren't that many books at the time. Helped move the books to the new library. That became, I think what it became, I haven't got a clue. But right now, currently, it is used by the development office. It's you know, offices, people mm-hmm. doing you know, research and finding donors and things like that. But that hallway had a little barbershop. Well, it was a room that the barber came from off campus and gave haircuts.
Paul Argel came.
There was a student bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
There was a day student room, day student lounge.
Yeah.
Bathroom, and then on down.
Yeah.
And I don't know what was the very end of it, but none of that. Now it's all, and frankly, it was kind of a
dismal,
dank
spot.
And dingy
yeah.
hallway. Yeah,
yeah.
So now it's been spruced up some, but it's either offices or all of the various server rooms for all the computer systems
mm-hmm,
and those kinds of things are located down there, and it's been kind of updated, but it doesn't have to look fancy for that kind of stuff.
No, it doesn't.
So now it's sort of just a pass-through for most of us.
So the faculty has grown in number. More courses are being offered. The physical plant has changed. How about the atmosphere of a boys' school? Has that changed over the time in general?
I would like to say that we are doing a better job, we the faculty are doing a better job of educating them, in the sense that when I was there, and for some years after, I mean, there was some hazing. I mean, the kind
yeah.
of thing you hear about at boys' institutions, for, you know, everywhere from military academies
too.
To, yeah. And I think, you know, it would be naive, I think, to say that we've totally eliminated stuff like that. It's the same thing in the public schools.
You never can. You never can.
But I think we do a better job. We've sort of, and part of this is through the sports program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sort of encourage the idea that, well, the what's the Shakespeare, the band of brothers kind of thing,
yeah.
you know, the brothers in arms,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so coaches kind of play with that. And we do, well, we're starting school next week. We'll have an orientation where those kinds of things, community, loyalty,
mm-hmm. It's bonding.
Citizenship are yeah. going to be stressed, are going to be talked about. And I, you know, it's a tough thing because, I think adolescent males are sort of xenophobic. They don't like the other that much.
Yeah.
There's a tribal quality to it. And we are a very diverse school. We, you know, we have the jocks and we have the, you know, the guys
the
who
are,
but we also have the arts. We have a lot of foreign students, Eastern
European
students,
or
some, a fair number of European, but,
Asian,
but a lot of Asian, from various,
countries,
China,
mm-hmm.
Japan, Korea,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that's kind of on our radar, and we
yeah, you're aware.
Try to, you know, we try to encourage them to be open minded and to be.
It's a good trick if you can
do
it.
To
you're teaching tolerance.
Yeah.
Basically, you're teaching tolerance, and it doesn't make any difference whether they're
and it helps.
Or
in some ways, the diversity helps us, because if we can get a guy, if we can get a fellow who is who's an athlete, but is also a good student,
mm-hmm.
that's a good message.
It's
to
a good
send.
Role model.
If we have somebody who is, I'm thinking of a fellow last year who was really well liked among his peers. He was an excellent athlete. He went out on a limb and did he got a major role in one of the drama productions. And he really put himself out there. And, you know, that kind of thing, I mean, it's good for him. I think it's a good example.
Yep.
We try to highlight if there's a fellow, like, we have a young man who's a very talented musician, piano player. Or there are other guys,
mm-hmm.
guys who play the guitar, guys. And they will come in and do, like, in the chapel in the mornings. We have Tuesday and Friday morning chapels. And sometimes that service will be
student
dedicated to them performing.
Oh, cool. Is it, I'm going to use the word a closed campus, in learning about Hotchkiss and learning about Salisbury, it seems that Hotchkiss has had a slightly more relationship with town people, and Salisbury seems to stay up on the hill more. Is that changing? Is it the same? I know I was going to throw you some curves.
I'm not sure that that's a fair assessment. I mean.
Okay. Explain to me.
There were a number of years running, and it's changed. We still have. Its form has changed somewhat, but we have this community service program. And there were a number of years running where we did town-centered community service. We had a community service day where every student went off and did something. One year they pulled invasive species with the land trust people.
They
cleaned up stuff, debris behind Noble. The focus of that community service has changed from being a sort of school-wide thing to being advisee-centered. And last year, Dennis Shortell and myself, we took all our advisees down, and we cleaned up a bunch of debris along Wildcat Hollow, Dark Hollow Road. There were a bunch of, and because I live right close to there, and I spend a lot of time, or I've walked the dog, and I'm up Dark Hollow Road fairly often, and there were these big tractor tires laying down there for years and years, and
let's clean it up.
We just went down one Sunday morning with a school truck and dragged them away.
Yep.
It gave Tom Key a little bit of a puzzle. he was like at the next land trust meeting. He was like, "Does anybody know
happened
to those tires? Did you miss them? Do you want them back?"
Good.
But he was worried about the viability issues, and I asked the people that had, the powers that be at school, and they said, no, there wouldn't be any problem with that. So
good.
So we just went and did it. But
these are things that I don't know, and I've just read past history. So
yeah.
I'm not familiar with current, and that's why I'm asking.
I'm not familiar with all of the... I mean, I know that Rita Delgado, for instance, she's head of student activities. She takes guys to soup kitchens. I think that's in Torrington. That's not quite
that's
so
all right.
She takes Jewish students to temple on whatever day they do that, and at special various holidays, various high holidays.
Yep.
She'll do things like that.
So there is more of an outreach into various communities.
I think so.
Good. Good.
More, certainly more than when I was a student.
That's exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, when I was a student, and granted, this was a lot of years ago, it was very, very separate.
Yes.
Let's talk about your ivory tower. I mean,
yes.
I would go up there and I'd be there all day, and and guys didn't get off campus as much. I mean, there wasn't a taxi service. If you wanted to go to Salisbury, you could ride your bike, you could walk, and we actually did that. I mean, guys
sure.
in 1970 did that. They walked to town with a bag or whatever and get groceries and stuff like that. But now, on the weekends, weekends are much freer weather weekends. Kids get away from school much more often. There are more dances. On Sunday afternoon, almost every Sunday, there's a shuttle that either goes to Millerton or goes to the Stop and Shop in Canaan, so students can...
stock up.
Can stock up. I haven't watched what they stock up on. It just
makes me
cringe.
You don't want to know.
Yeah, so they are less, now that's a sort of a separate issue. The students themselves are less tied to the Hilltop. They have more mobility. That's a separate issue than whether Salisbury School interacts with the local townspeople more.
But they do come
down, you know, like the Fall Festival, they come mm-hmm. down and they help out with that. That's mm-hmm. another one of the outlets for the community service mm-hmm. project. They'll help, you know, like move stuff, clean up, things like that.
How about Sunday services? If they're Catholics, do they get a shuttle service down to St. Mary's?
I believe so.
Okay.
That certainly used to be the case. Matt Corkery used to take guys to Catholic services.
Okay.
The other thing, now this no longer exists, but there was a period where Jackie Rice
mm-hmm.
was, we had a, as part of the science program, had an EMT course, and there were guys from Salisbury who could take
yeah.
her class, and then they'd go down Thursday evenings to the ambulance garage and they'd do the EMT course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Jackie doesn't, now works at the high school, and they don't do that anymore.
No.
But that was, there was a period of time when that was a, you know, that was another...
Activity. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about Salisbury School before we go on to some earlier memories?
Hmm.
Obviously, you enjoy teaching there because you've been a long time there.
Well, what's not to like? I mean,
yeah,
you get long vacations. I mean, I still think of myself as an artist, though I always, you know, to call oneself an artist, is, to me,
yeah.
smacks of sort of self...
Yeah, self-aggrandizement.
You know, promotion, but it meant that, you know, I had long vacations that I could get artwork done. It kept me active because I was coaching or doing outdoor...
What
know,
did you
exercise
coach?
Kind of thing. Well, over the years, I've coached wrestling, cycling. And now I do a activity called rock climbing. That's what it sounds like. And I'm again the cycling coach, but now we're a recreational program mm-hmm. instead of a competitive program. And there are a few other activities, you know, sort of in between there. But mostly the rec. Wrestling, cycling, and rock climbing. So yeah, it's kind of a nice, you know.
You enjoy what you're doing.
Things, you know, things change with the season, and
yeah.
I do a number of different things. It's not like I'm always teaching the same class. I mean, and I can even change the projects a little bit if I get tired.
Yeah, sure.
If I'm printmaking and I get tired of a particular project or if something's not working, I can switch
yeah.
gears
you've
and
you've got
find
the flexibility,
that works, yeah, that works
which
better.
Is good. You don't have to teach to a specific test.
Yes.
Which is
right.
quite a lot of freedom.
The yeah. With the boat building, the test I teach to is it's got to float.
Yeah, well, that, you know, unlike your coracle, it went...
yeah.
Or whatever. I asked you about the Methodist Church, and you remembered a little bit about the Methodist Church that Jerry Pollock was
right.
Kind of laid back and open, and it was a good time.
Yeah.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
But I didn't ask you, I did ask you about Camp Sloan, and you said that you had gone to Camp Sloan from the Methodist Church.
I think it was the Methodist Church that had a certain number of what they call ninth week
yeah.
scholarships
yeah,
every year. And the funny thing, there were a couple of us, a guy named Dave Orosky, myself, somebody else. But, I mean, Dave lived at Deep Lake Farm at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But which was kind of funny because we used to sit in the tent at night. The ninth week was usually, well, let's see. On at least one occasion, we were in the tent, and everybody's getting to know each other, talking about where you live, and Dave like points out the tent. There's my house
yeah.
down there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And they were like, "Why are you coming to camp?"
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was fun. There were activities. It was, you know, we got to meet different people. That sometimes the counselors were from, you know, one year we had a counselor who I think was from India.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, international.
Yeah.
Oh, very definitely.
And so, yeah, it was a fun experience.
Great. But I
did ninth week for like, I don't know, several years in a row. I never did the full camp.
Well, that's all right. It was set up at that time, I think, two periods of 4 weeks for the other campers. And then they had this 1 week that they didn't really have anything going. And because it had Methodist connections, fellow that was running it contacted Jerry Pollock, and he filled up that ninth week with kids, which was a wonderful idea.
Yeah, it was great.
Now, your mother taught at Salisbury Central. Any memories of Salisbury Central that you care to share, or shall we leave that at this?
Well, you know, I really like Salisbury Central, and I thought it was a great school.
It was.
My own 12-year-old is going to be an eighth grader this year.
Wow.
I've never felt like, we got to send him to Indian Mountain, or you know, nothing wrong with Indian Mountain.
No.
Nothing wrong with Salisbury Central either, and he seems to be getting a
good education.
Good education. I get a little confused because I go up there now and it's all been rearranged.
Oh yes.
The building is rearranged, but I have kind of, you know, fond memories of Salisbury Central. I was part of the audiovisual club with
Bob Kosesky,
and we ran these little film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
I think 5 and 5 before Christmas and after Christmas. I could be wrong about that, but that was my sort of introduction to kind of the movies.
Yeah,
and oddly enough, later on, at that point when I was out of college, but before I started teaching at Salisbury, one of my part-time jobs was I was a projectionist at the Mahaley Theater in Great Barrington.
Really?
And which was like a step up. It was
sure.
It was a little bit more. The equipment was a little fancier.
Oh, yeah.
But not that much more. I mean, the system of having the two projectors, so you could go from reel to reel.
I did it for 4 years in college.
Was the same.
Yeah. And you didn't have self-winders. You had to thread them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we had to, and then we had to, at the Mahaley, we had to rewind the film repackage it, you know, at the end of the week.
It's fun threading a machine in the dark, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that room now, the room that was, well, it was the... It was the art room, and the projectors were there on the side.
Right.
Now it's John Conklin's science classroom, which I've been to a number of times for teacher conferences when we go to,
I haven't been to the lower building since they reworked it.
Yeah.
So I'll have to do that sometime.
It's changing. Yeah, there are parts of it that are still sort of recognizable, some of the corridors, but some of it I just can't quite remember how it went.
Did you get... And I don't know whether this is politically correct or not, but did you get any flack from being a teacher's child at Salisbury Central? If you can't remember, then you didn't.
If I did, it didn't leave a lasting
Lasting
scar.
Mark.
There may have been some of that, but not really.
I never picked up anything on the Romeo children or you or your brother. It was, you know, everybody knew everybody, and it was a community.
I mean, I didn't have my mother in homeroom, if we had such a thing as homeroom. I don't remember having her as a teacher.
Probably
I think
not.
I remember that. But no, not really.
Because we had a lot of kids that went through that their parents were teachers there, and there may have been an issue as to whether I call you Mom or I call you Mrs. McKee, but that was a personal thing. But
I probably got more flack for being sort of pudgy and not very athletic.
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. Okay. Civic activities. Tell me about the ambulance.
Well, I did the ambulance squad. Because I was doing that sophomore wilderness trip that I mentioned, and because I was doing a lot of outdoor stuff myself, camping, hiking, mountain biking, rock climbing, etc., I decided at some point in time that it would be a really good idea for me to have some sort of first aid training. And I took a wilderness first responder course from an outfit in up in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
The school actually paid for it. Because I was doing these things with kids.
Yeah.
And the school, it was sort of faculty development. The school mm-hmm. paid for this weekend. It was a Yeah, it was a weekend course. I think Friday, Saturday, Sunday. No, hold it. I'm getting confused. I'm thinking of my. I also took a high angle rescue course, which was a slightly different thing. Now, the first responder course was a nine day thing, and it took place at Hurricane Island off the main coast, which Hurricane Island is where Outward Bound used to have its headquarters. They don't believe they do anymore. But, so it was 10 days of, you know, fairly intense. I mean, the days were long. They had us out on the island doing scenarios where, you know, somebody would pose as a victim, you know, and they'd even have a little makeup on them, you know, to simulate something or other. And when I came back from that and started up the fall school year, Jackie Rice, who was at the time, she was teaching, she said, well, you've got your woman as first responder. It would be easy for you to take the
EMT,
EMT course. So I did, and the rest is... And one of the... There was Jackie, a fellow named Mark Henning, who was a teacher there as well. He was on the A1 squad, and so he kind of encouraged me as well. And over the years, we've had a few faculty members who have joined the squad, and, you know... So I did that for 15 years, I think. And it finally just got to be too much. I frankly don't know how I managed to do it when Duncan was a baby. But I did. But just a few years ago, it kind of got to be too much, and so I...
Well, the training has increased tremendously that you have to have.
Yeah. We would do a lot of that. We would do, like, refresher stuff at our monthly
meetings. Yeah.
And then every year as they were doing the course, one of the functions of the squad members would be to come in and run the practice practical examinations for the students so that they would be well prepared when they went to the state to take their test. If anything, I think the testing has maybe even a little bit more straightforward. When I was doing it, you kind of walked in and you knew that there were certain stations you knew they were going to happen because they were important, like, you know, heart attack or, you know, cardiac arrest. But the everything else, maybe out of seven stations, three you kind of knew it was going to be there, and then the other four were sort of random. And so you could walk in on anything. It could be a gunshot wound. It could be, and you worked with your partner, and your partner could either drag you down or lift you up, depending on who you
were partnered with.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was,
intense.
It was kind of intense, but it felt good. You know, I felt like we were contributing. You know, there were, in a small town like this, you get a lot of cases which are not as critical, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Sure.
You know, and there are a few of the local doctors who sort of think of the ambulance as a taxi service. They'll call Noble and they'll say, we need to get the ambulance to take so-and-so down to the hospital for evaluation. And that's not really what the...
No, that's not what it's for.
Ambulance is for, but
no.
it's something...
It's a courtesy.
That, you know, up until, like, the last year I was there, Jackie would, you know, occasionally there, we'd discuss it in the meeting, and she'd say, well, I'll have another talk with Dr. So-and-so about, you know...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You joined in 1997?
That's what it says on my little brass pin. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, you got a little brass pin.
A little thing. It says, you know, and I, somewhere along the line, I think I even got my 15-year pin.
Probably.
But it was shortly after that I had to pack it in.
There's a burnout factor, too.
And the other thing that I found, as the years went on, I found that we were going on calls more and more for people that I knew.
Yes.
Like, you know, my old first grade teacher or, Carl Williams we picked up. But though Carl was the exception. We had a call to go to Carl's house and we show up at the door and Carl's like already down the stairs with his bag packed. And he said, no, you don't have to bring the stretcher up here. I'll come down. Okay. You know.
Whatever you say, Carl.
But yeah, it got, well, actually, I was on a call once where we picked up my mother. This was, and fortunately, it wasn't a serious, well, it, I guess broken hip is serious.
But, it's serious, but it's not life-threatening.
We get this call, we drive down, the call is, it's out in front of the post office in Lakeville. Mm-hmm. We drive down, and as I get out of the ambulance, Deb Fales comes around, and she says, you know, she kind of grabs me, she says, Roger, don't panic, it's your mom, you know.
Yeah.
And she had slipped, it was icy or whatever,
yeah.
She slipped and fallen and
yeah.
fractured her hip.
Yeah.
But I was just driving at that point, I don't think yeah. I did any of the patient care. But yeah, that was something that I hadn't sort of thought about too much going into it. And, you know, on the one hand, you have a sort of a personal relationship with the patient. You can say, you can talk to them because you know them. On the other hand, it's kind of disturbing to discover that the people that you looked up to when you were in grade school or whatever are
fragile.
Getting on in years and are fragile. Yeah,
it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's a mixed bag. But from like my point of view, it's very comforting to have somebody show up that I know.
Sure.
Because they're going to take care of me and I'm not in the hands of a stranger.
Yeah.
And I had said to Jackie Rice when I started interviewing her, I said, I'm doing this because I am so scared of hospitals and doctors and ambulances that I need to do this so I'm not so frightened.
Yeah.
And, that's a different perspective, but that's where I'm coming from. Now, you said you are involved with Land Trust as well.
Margaret Hohek got me. Whose husband is a Salisbury alum, by the way. And is also a Scotland buff, so we always have stuff to talk about a little bit. She was on the ambulance squad.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually on duty with me. Wednesdays was our day, and it would be me and Margaret and somebody else. And she said, you know, you like going out in the woods and walking around, and you know about GPS and mm-hmm. things like that, and you'd be a good person to volunteer for the Land Trust. And so I did, thinking, and that's still my main function. I mean, every member of the committee has certain properties that they're supposed to go out once a year and walk around and take some pictures and basically make sure that the requirements of the easement are being adhered
Observed.
To. Yeah.
How long have you been on the Land Trust?
Probably not so long. 3 years, maybe. Though that's another one that, you know, kind of gets away from you. We only meet every other month, so, you know.
Yeah.
It could have been more, but I think probably about 3 years.
Is there anything that you'd like to add in general, before we close this interview?
That the town of Lakeville, not so much Salisbury, but the town in general, has changed in so many ways, physically changed in so many ways. I always think about Lakeville because that whole central where the traffic light is, the boathouse was Morris Brickman's
grocery store.
Across the way there was the jewelry shop, the Mr. Berry's jewelry mm-hmm. shop. There was little Danny Goffredo's
cobbler shop.
A whole raft of buildings. There was a little diner with a cool enameled Coke sign. I wish I could get my hands on that sign. I bet it'd be worth some money now. Arbel's barbershop was upstairs.
Yep.
There was the Five and Dime. There was the A&P
mm-hmm.
liquor store, I think.
Yep.
Then Ward Finkel's golf station.
Mm-hmm. It's all gone.
All that's gone. And so now it's like kind of... I hear every time there's a discussion of low-income housing, I hear people saying, talking about preserving the look or the rural quality of the town. And I want to say, the town didn't look like this 30 years ago. No. This is not a long-term thing.
It was busier
then. Even Salisbury, okay, the little sporting goods clothing store.
Peterbeck, that used to be Lebon's. Shagroy's.
Yeah, it was Shagroy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the Chinese restaurant, which unfortunately is now defunct,
that was the Apothecary Cafe.
This is a discussion I occasionally have with one of my colleagues up at school. The zoning regulations now, I think it's a 2-acre lot. Mm-hmm. If those zoning regulations had been in effect when my parents moved to Perry Street or the little houses on Porter Street, mm-hmm. those little neighborhoods wouldn't exist
because
my parents' lot was a 1/2 acre.
Yeah.
And some of them, I think, were even smaller. But those are perfectly nice little neighborhoods, wonderful places kids live there.
Oh, yeah.
But, I don't know.
It's more spread out than it used to be.
Yeah. And the the idea that what we're seeing right now is what a little New England town ought to look like is misguided.
It's misguided. You're absolutely right.
But anyway,
thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's been interesting, and I've learned a lot, and that's the best part of the whole thing. Well, thank you so much, Roger.
Well, you're welcome.